So, seriously, last night in Meron, probably it was a little hotter than normal, so people stayed away, but estimates are that on a yearly basis, 600,000 people gather in Meron. Very few of them from Migdolos, but nonetheless, 600,000 people. Sometimes estimates run as high as 700,000 people. This is the largest gathering on an annual basis in the entire state of Israel, larger even than all the mega funerals. So there's a lot of excitement and a lot of assembling and a lot of gathering and convening. And there's also a lot of eye rolling, especially people in our world who aren't into Kabbalah and don't know what to make of Kabbalah. And the optics of last night are a little bit strident. Fire, people throwing cell phones into fire, slaughtering goats, blood. You look at it, it seems a little foreign, seems a little ancient and outdated, not something that you, let's say, study in your class in college, and not about the New York Times articles. And it leads to a sense of, well, this Kabbalah, it's all magic, ancient hocus-pocus, witchcraft. We're in the enlightened, the rational world, and anyone who's into Kabbalah. So I want to talk about Kabbalah with you. What is Kabbalah? Where does it come from? What role does it play? How does it evolve? And then more importantly, given the assumption that very few of you are going to become Mekubalot, Mekubalim, what role can Kabbalah play in your life? If you're not going to be into Kabbalah, what role can Kabbalah play? So that for the rest of your life, when you hear Kabbalah or someone says, I'll pee Kabbalah something, you don't get into eye rolling, oh yeah, here he goes again, that's silly, that doesn't make sense, it's not rational. Okay, what's the problem? The problem is twofold. Internally, we as a yeshiva world, as a Torah world, have moved into the world of what's called nigla. Nigla means exoteric as opposed to esoteric. The world of ration, the world of empiricism, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Those are very different terms. 1801, 1803, Reb Chaim Volozhin builds the first mega yeshiva. Obviously, the yeshiva movement until recently is primarily for boys and men, but what happens to men affects families and women as well, secondarily. Now it's more directly. But these yeshivas are focusing on learning Gemara, not much else, learning halacha. Not so much Tanakh and Chumash. Chumash starts to enter in the 20th century. Machshava a little bit more. Machshava meaning Mori Nevuchim. Machshava meaning Musar in many yeshivos. Tanakh, obviously in the modern context, but very little Kabbalah. So there's been a shift away from the world of Kabbalah, in part because Chassidus reconfigures Kabbalah in very dramatic fashion. We're not going to talk about Chassidus now, but as you know, there's a real polarization between the original yeshiva movement and Chassidus, until they once again merge. Chassidus adopts, embraces Kabbalah. Reflexively, Chaim Volozhin and his troops move away from Kabbalah. So we're working over a 200-year cycle in which Kabbalah doesn't really enter our curriculum. You don't know what it is. It sounds like it's something out there, but a very murky, vague sense of what that Kabbalah is. Little different if you went down the road. Let's say, as you know, there's a whole, someone asked me, I was speaking on a panel a couple of weeks ago in Baltimore, and they asked me to describe the national religious world to them. And just to give you again a sense, this is not a modern Orthodox world, this is called a national religious world. Modern Orthodoxy is primarily focused, for better or for worse, upon how to integrate classic Talmud Torah, classic mitzvos, classic Avodas Hashem from 1612 into a modern world that has embraced Jews, into modern culture, into thought, into the world surrounding us. That's what that world, modern Orthodoxy, is concerned with. National religious world, it overlaps in certain areas, but the national religious world is primarily concerned with how to integrate classic religion, classic Torah, classic Avodas Hashem into state building. It's a whole different challenge. The overlap is the state of Israel. But our world, its intellectual ferment, is not primarily about whether Shakespeare or Kierkegaard or secular universities or the culture around us can add and enrich the world of Avodas Hashem. We think about it, but it's not really the core nucleus of this movement. The core nucleus of this movement is we have to build a state. We have to worry about religion and its impact upon religious Jews, non-religious Jews, Shemitah, Shabbos, police, army, culture, Eurovision, everything. And that's the thermodynamics of our community. Within the national religious community, there tends to be, again, I don't like divisions. I hate divisions, subdivisions within divisions. Remember a couple months ago, we were having a conversation at our Shabbos table. This is a sidebar to a sidebar to a sidebar. So my daughter just had a symposium in her high school. And they talked about all the different hashkafos in today's Torah world. Haredi, Chassidish, Dati Lumi. She came and said, Abba, what are we? I said, we're Ovdei Hashem. What do you mean? What are we? We're Ovdei Hashem. You don't stamp yourself, I'm this, I'm that. It's ridiculous. These are movements that are less than 200 years old. I can guarantee you in 200 years, all these classifications will disappear. These are shields of honor, collections of ideas just to process these really traumatic events such as the Holocaust, seismic shifts such as the State of Israel, Enlightenment. So people have to gather around certain ideas, create camps. 200 years, no one's going to know what modern Orthodoxy is. No one's going to know what Haredi is. It's just 200 years ago, no one knew what they are. It's just in the moment, in the last 100 years, people have to create communities around ideas. So we're Ovdei Hashem. Now, if you ask me which community do I choose to live in, I made a choice 30 years ago to live in the national religious community. I don't call myself a national religious. I don't think we have a monopoly on Avodas Hashem. I think there's certain parts of my community that leave a lot to be desired, certain parts from other communities I deeply emulate. And the second you stamp yourself, you're essentially substituting identity and substance for artificial stereotypes and labels, and that's a poor man's excuse for substance. You're going to be substantive, you grow, you develop ideas, values, behavior, try to improve yourself, you want to be as perfect as possible. The only label I can call myself, and the only label you should ever call yourself, if someone asks you what type of Jew you are, you're an ultra-Orthodox Jew. I refuse to allow that label to define anyone but myself. Because if you ever feel that your approach isn't ultra-Orthodox, you have a religious responsibility to find the approach that you think is the most orthodox. I don't look at the Haredi approach as superior. I look at my approach as, for me, the best approach. And I've seen people who have excelled in that approach, and I'm driven to be the best I can at this approach. And for other people, there are other approaches that are superior. I don't see that as ultra-orthodox. I don't see mine. For me, this is ultra-orthodoxy. And the second you start using that term about other people, you're equating yourself. Well, they're the ultra-orthodox. I'm the half-orthodox. I'm the semi-orthodox. I'm the semi-sweet orthodox. I'm the half-brew orthodox. So you're giving yourself a ticket out. You're giving yourself a discount. Well, I'll keep mitzvahs sometimes, not that deeply, because after all, they're the ultra-orthodox. I'm the half and half-orthodox. It's ridiculous. So within the communities that people refer to as the Dati Lumi or national religious, so some community, there some one subgroup people refer to, just close the door, I just don't want to compete with the girls. One subgroup, thank you, that people refer to as Gushnikim. People that have been influenced by the Gush Yeshiva, and yeshivas like that, but looking to the Gush as maybe the oldest and the grounds from where other yeshivas came in the Hezder world, be it yeshivas like Otniel, which is very deeply influenced, Yerucham, Male Adumim, places like that, Kfar Batya. And then on the other part of that community is what people call the Kavnik yeshivas. Kav in Hebrew means a line. And those tend to be yeshivas that were deeply influenced by Rav Kook. Rav Kook's primary yeshiva being Merkaz Harav, yeshiva founded in his spirit. And subsidiary places such as Beit El, Elon Moreh, Har Bracha, Har Hamor, Eli, Atzmona, yeshivas like that. These are the dominant, influential yeshivas in the Kavnik world. Just to give you a sense, Har Hamor just opened a new yeshiva in Yerushalayim, and the Beis Medrash has 800 seats. I think the Gush is about 420. So it's double the size of the Gush Beis Medrash. Just to give you a sense of proportion. That world is certainly more influenced by Rav Kook. If you're asking one of the major differences, by the way, one of the major differences is women's learning. In that world, women's seminaries, women's midrashot, learn very differently than, so to speak, Migdal Oz being the paradigm of the Olpanot in the Gush world, where there's text-based encounters. And there it's very much shaping ideology, shaping values, shaping who you'll be as a mother, as a wife, as a person, rather than opening text. And again, these are benefits that don't fall into that simplistic triumphalism, flag-waving, this is perfect. No equation is perfect. Check your stigmas, check your stereotypes at the door. If you want to be a real person, you study real issues, you're tenacious, you find the drawbacks, you find from one of Rav Lichtenstein's legacy, if you ask me when I can hear Rav Aaron's tonality, is I want to hear even-handedness And if there's lopsidedness and harsh critique, it's inflective and self-reflective rather than projective. Whenever he would assess the Haredi or non-Haredi, whenever he would assess different communities, he would offer even-handed, objective assessments of other communities, but then when he looked inward, it was lopsided. Here we have to improve, here we have to improve, here we have to improve. That's really the secret of life. Judge yourself more harshly than you judge others. Mirrors used to work. I heard they don't work so well anymore. Look in the mirror. Look at what's looking back at you. People used to like looking at mirrors. People don't look at them too much. I heard they don't work anymore so well. You don't see yourself. See other people. Look in the mirror, look at yourself carefully as an individual, as a community, and don't drown out the noise. It's not a question of Olympics, a question of who's better and who's doing better, who's going to win the ideological Olympics, this approach, that approach. Our community, how can we improve? How can we not improve? How can I be part of a community and understand the built-in limitations and supersede them with personal adjustments and calibrations? So in that world of Cook's world, there's a greater sensitivity to Kabbalah, because Rav Kook was deeply, deeply influenced by Kabbalah. And that translates in his works. I don't know if you've learned that much of Kook this year. A little bit. But you'll see it and you'll feel it. Okay, so, but in our world, going back to the original point, Kabbalah has faded a little bit from the Torah curriculum. It's Gemara, it's Halacha, it's Tanakh, it's Machshava, it's Musar, it's... And on top of that, the general milieu of the modern world is hyper-rationalist and scientific, the age of ration. Ration's had a pretty good 400-year run. This is the age of reason, enlightenment, science, technology, discovery, and everything from that old world feels very stale and very yellow. Those people who thought the earth was flat, who thought that blood coursed through your body in waves rather than being pumped by a central mechanism, who thought that nature was random and didn't discover natural selection, who thought that they couldn't create a better form of energy, who thought that those old people who made these egregious errors about assessing their world, we're the enlightened ones. We've brought nature to its heels. And that's generally very anachronistic. It's certainly not true morally, as there's been an intellectual evolution. There's been a moral decline, for sure. Interactively, we're far less connected to people. Family, community has suffered because of enlightenment values. So everything is always this balancing. What has changed? How have we progressed? What have we suffered in? So we're living in 2019, and anything that isn't rational, isn't a math equation, not going to win the Nobel Peace Prize, the Nobel Prize for Science, can't be reduced to a syllogism or a formula. It all of a sudden elicits our deep suspicion. What's happening here? What is that about? How can I make sense of that? And especially if you're sitting in Migdal Oz facing this 200-year influence of the rationalism in Judaism and in the Torah world of non-Hasidus. So that's the bias I'm here to break today. I like breaking biases. I like, you know, lie detector. Make sure I give you a lie detector just to keep you honest, because you fall into these ruts and you just think robotically and reflexively. You get yourself into stale thought. You just mindless thought. It's not fresh. It's not real. It's not. Break the stare. Say, what is really here? Can I see? These are smart people. You're not the only one who's smart. You're not the only one who knows what they're doing. People out there are taken by this. They're also smart. Believe in people. They're not idiots. They're not fools. They're not all making hundreds of thousands of people making terrible mistakes and being led blindly. What's out there? How is it affecting them? Okay. That's number one. What are we facing? Here's the uphill struggle. Let's climb the mountain together, okay? Walk out of here and say, you know what? I'm not a Makubal, but I understand what's happening. What is Kabbalah? Okay? Kabbalah is not mysticism. That is an incorrect translation, okay? So let me define Kabbalah, and then what do people mean when they say Kabbalah is mysticism? Kabbalah means traditions, transmissions, received truths. Why is it referred to as such? Okay. Kabbalah studies the worlds, not just the world. We live in a world amongst other worlds. I don't just mean other worlds like other planets. That's part of our world. That's part of the universe. But everything comes from Hashem. There's nothing in this world that isn't delivered and created by the Rabbanu Shalom. There's no reality. Hashem is the makom. Hashem is the space. Just like you're living in space, if you zoom out, Lom Shavot, Israel, Middle East, Earth, solar system, yeah. What happens if you reach the end of the universe? Let's say you're zooming out on Google and you're at the end, because you're going to reach some end of the universe. What happens if you zoom out past the end of the universe? That's Hashem. It's like you're contained in the universe. the universe is contained in Hashem. So there's nothing outside of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So how does Hashem's infinite non-physical presence, watch me, to a cup of water? How does that happen? Hashem isn't a cup of water. Hashem isn't molecules. How does that happen? How do we go from infinity, lack of physicality, can't even, it's not just lack of physicality, it can't even be spoken about, because once you say something in language, it now becomes finite and contained. Hashem isn't even capturable in language or in concept. Then all of a sudden it becomes a cup of water. In our world, we start with a cup of water. That's where that's our starting point. Where do we find water? How does water interact? What is it? It's, we live in the universe, upper water is love. It's there already. Palpable reality is there already. But how does it become palpable reality? So there are multiple worlds that allow this trickling down. In Hebrew, it's called hishtalshelut, trickling down through basically four worlds. Right now, Atzilus, Bria, Yetzirah, Asiya, just if we need to know the names, Aleph, Beis, Yud, Ayin. There's a world in between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and those four worlds. And Kabbalah is riveted on that question. Now, you can't prove those worlds, which means that Kabbalah is not empirical truth. This is empirical truth. I can take a molecule of this water, put it under the microscope, and dissect it and deconstruct it molecularly. What are the subatomic particles? I can conduct experiments on it. Even history that is difficult to prove is at least theoretically verifiable. Har Sinai is an event. It's verifiable. I don't think you can verify it, but in theory, if we just had proper tools, and we could go back and find the mountain. In theory, you can develop tools, algorithms, big data, collect, in theory. Just let your mind wander. We can't. We'll probably never get there. But in theory, it's verifiable. We could collect enough of that dust on Har Sinai, conduct DNA experiments, find Nadav and Avihu's burned at, then it happened. We can, but in theory, it's empirical knowledge. In theory, we could prove creation. If we would develop an algorithm or a method to discriminate between ex nihilo creations or reconfigurations of matter, we could prove HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. We can't. But at least it's verifiable. It's there. The data's there. The material's there. We just don't have the tools to conduct the experiments. Who would have thought that 100 years ago we could have big data predicting your trends and sending you recommendations on Google, put a man to them. And so as our tools change, our reach changes. But there's a set of verifiable experiences, places, events. There's no empirical way to prove worlds you can't see, that you just don't have access to. They're beyond the universe. The universe is a product of. There's no way to prove that. So it's not empirical. That's why it's called Kabbalah. You have to receive information, to receive the stories. But it is rational. It's not mystical. And people, please listen to this very carefully. Always studied Kabbalah. And I'll tell you who studied Kabbalah. You'd be surprised. And when they studied Kabbalah, they sat at a table the same way you're sitting at a table, with a pen and paper and a book and a mind, and they thought about, what does this world mean? What is this trait? What is this dimension? How does it make its way through? Now, the baseline data wasn't available empirically. It had to be delivered, but once it was delivered, it could be analyzed and applied and discussed. So there's nothing mystical about studying Kabbalah. Studying Kabbalah is like studying math or like studying a blot Gemara. You have the information and you dissect, analyze, apply, compare, contrast. But how do you get the information that you can only get by receiving? So it's not empirical, it's rational. Now, there were certain strains of Kabbalah that were also mystical experientially. What do I mean mystical experientially? Okay, since HaKadosh Baruch Hu is non-physical, is infinite, is indivisible, is something unfathomable, no word I say can even begin to apply to him, because every word I say is culled from human experience that's completely irrelevant to him. He's not big, he's not small, he's not tall, he's not short, he's not tasty, he's not untasty, he's not have glasses, there's nothing. Every word in my mind comes from experience. That doesn't apply to Hashem, who's beyond experience. So how do I relate to him? So a non-mystic says, and that includes a Mekubal, says, okay, I'll perform his mitzvahs, I'll obey him, I'll study his will, I'll try to behave morally like him, I'll live in his land, I'll work for his people, but essentially I'll never really know him. Now a non-Mekubal says, you know what, I'm not even going to think about how his essence translates in this world, I'll start in this world. I know that he commanded Avraham, he delivered the Torah, and in this world, if I don't think about those other worlds, these are the ways I can get close to him. Chesed, mitzvot, Torah, Maisim. Non-mystical Mekubal, so this is the first type of Mekubal we spoke about, says, I also want to study how Hashem makes his way into this physical world. A mystic, Mekubal says, I don't just want to accept that difference and distance between myself and a Kodesh Baruch Hu, either starting in this world or even thinking about the way Hashem makes his way into this world, but not really being him. I want to bridge the gap. I want to feel a higher level of Hashem's presence beyond this world. Well, for me to do that, I have to enter mystical experiences, suspend my ration, enter into altered states of being in order to bridge the gap. That's mysticism. That's a very, very, not very minor strain. It becomes popular in the 12th century in Spain. Rabbi Avraham Abulafia, Wiki, I don't have to tell you the history. But it's not mainstream Kabbalah. Almost every single, I'll talk about this in a few moments, every single major member of our medieval Masara was a Mekubal. The Ramban, you read the Ramban from time to time? The core of every Sugyan Jas was a Mekubal. In his Perash El HaTorah, he's always writing the Kabbalah part. We tend to skip it, because we don't really understand it. The Rashba, his Talmud, Mekubal, wrote Svarim on Kabbalah. The Ravid, Mekubal, wrote Sifrei Kabbalah. Shulchan Aruch, Mekubal. Rama, Reb Moshe Chaim Lutzato, Maharal, Vilna Gaon, his Talmidim. You'd have to struggle to find major impactors of our Masara who didn't study or even write Svarim and Kabbalah. Probably the most famous one is Rambam. Rambam doesn't talk about Kabbalah. There are certain clash points between Kabbalah and the Rambam. Maybe I'll talk about this a bit later. He doesn't talk about it. Rav Kook supposedly said that HaKadosh Baruch Hu kept Kabbalah from the Rambam. The Rambam had enough. You ask me why I'm not into Kabbalah. Explain how Kabbalah affects me. Why am I not into Kabbalah? Because I can live 10,000 lives and still not maximize, more or less, my Avodas Hashem in the world of exoteric, rational Judaism. I have to finish Shas. It's going to take me 100,000 lifetimes to finish Shas the way I want to. 100,000 lifetimes to correct my personality the way I want to. A little less Tanakh, but it's taking me a lot of lifetimes to learn Tanakh the way I want to. So, like everything else, as you find out in life, it's really hard to be good at one thing. And the second you try to be good at multiple things, you become less good at that first thing. It's called specialization. You try to shave your world down. See, I want to be really good at these two or three or four things. You try to be good at too many things, you end up really quickly being mediocre at everything. Try to learn too many things, you don't know your limits, you know a lot about everything and nothing about anything. It becomes very shallow. So what I tell myself, and people like me tell myself, is I've got X amount of years in this life. Cut off the time I sleep, the time I spend with my I'll be lucky if I finish an eighth of Shas the way I want to. A 60th of Shas the way I want to. So why should I disperse and scatter my energies? It doesn't mean I'm ignoring the world of Kabbalah. I'm ignoring it, but it just means that it's bunk. And it just means the Rambam rebuilt the world of rational Judaism. He rebuilt the map of Torah. How many parts of Torah are there? Ever think about that question? Because the Kodesh Baruch Hu didn't give a billion details. There are quadrants, there are sectors. How many sectors of Torah are there? I don't know. What would you say in the year 80? You'd say five, right? Because five chamisha chamshei Torah. But that's historiographical, not logical, right? That's just the way the Torah was delivered. It doesn't represent topics and themes. How many themes are there in the Torah? It's a hard question. Until the Rambam said there are 14. And in the Rambam's map, now you can say, okay, let me look down at Torah and say, okay, I can create 14 quadrants to Torah. Mada, the thought, the concepts of Torah. Ahava. The mitzvahs that demonstrate how you view religion. Zmanim, Nashim, Kedusha, Hafla, Zrayim, Taras, Kerbanas, Avoda, Kinyan, Nezikim, Mishpatim, Shoftim. And the Torah comes along and says, oh, okay, now, you know what? 14 is nice. Let's boil it down to 4. It's easier to think of 4 than 14. Orachayim. Mitzvos. Festivals. Eben Ha'ezer. Domesticity. Marriage. Yoredea. Household. Kashrus. Kedusha. Choshe Mishpat. Financial interest. That's easier. So look at what the Rambam did for us. He didn't just deliver more information. He gave us a whole new processor. It's like you want to improve your computer. Today they make tablets. You don't really open it up. But it used to be we looked under the hood, and I used to be a real tinkerer with computers. What if I take this piece? It blew up. And I put this piece in. I was a wild scientist. And he said, take a piece here, put a piece here. So the most basic piece you change in your computer is you change the processor. Because that's what we're all processors through. You change the hard drive, put a couple extra pictures on your hard drive. You change the peripherals, get a nicer printer. Change the processor. It's even more important than RAM. RAM is onboard storage. Processor is every time you issue a command on the computer, you're coursing through that processor. So the Rambam gave us a new processor. We can process information differently, think about it differently. So of course it makes sense that the Rambam wasn't distracted by Kabbalah in taking that Rav Kook statement. But getting back to our view before, everyone studied Kabbalah. If you went back to yeshiva 300 years ago, of course part of your day was studying the Kabbalah of the Rashba, or the, say, 16th century Tzfat Mekubalah, maybe practice Kabbalah. Of course you studied Kabbalah. So don't use the word mysticism. That's a mistake. As if Mekubalim are levitating in thin air, gravitating to the heavens, substance introduction to suppress their ration, wandering through the forests, and they're sitting at a table throughout the centuries, like you are right now, thinking about worlds that we can't see, and there's information you can't prove empirically, but it's a very rational experience, unless you're also a mystic on top of a Makuba. Okay, second aspect of Kabbalah, just to clarify, what is Kabbalah? It's not mysticism. Third aspect, how does it originate? Where does it start? Well, here's the issue. The actual Svarim of Kabbalah are very late in the game. So if you're looking at when the Svarim appear, 7th century, Sefer Hayitzira, 12th century in France, Sefer HaBahir, famously 13th century Spain, Sefer HaZohar. And of course, if you're an academic, if you're a professor, you base yourself on the data. And the data said, well, this is when the book first appears. So you can't assume that the tradition is anything older than that. So the Zohar starts in the 13th century in Spain. But we don't just base ourselves on data. We base ourselves on transmission, on Kabbalah. And our Masara tells us that, yeah, the Sfarim were written in the 13th century. And maybe they were even intentionally suppressed because it's esoteric and because it talks about. But we have even documentation going all the way back to Yechezkel and Perek Yud. And Perek Aleph talks about Masa Merkava and Masa Bracious. And again, if you're the Rambam, these mean physics, not Kabbalah. Metaphysics, which is philosophy, not Kabbalah. Philosophy is all, it's all verifiable. It's not verifiable because it's concepts and concepts, but it's all ideas about why we were created, how we were created, rather than how these other worlds, right? Philosophy starts in this world. Physics starts in this terrain, terrestrial. Physics will not talk about concepts. It talks about material. Metaphysics talks about higher than concepts. It's all about this world. What are the concepts of our world? Not about concepts of those other worlds. That's Kabbalah. Those are higher realms, other worlds. But we have Yechezkel talking about Masa Merkava. What carries Hashem into this world? What's the chariot upon which Hashem rides? How does Hashem make his way into this world, in this physical world? We have the Gemara talking about Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Oshia sitting on Erev Shabbos, every Erev Shabbos, learning Sefer HaYetzirah and 3D printing a calf to eat that Shabbos. Not 3D printing, but Sefer HaYetzirah, creating calves, because Sefer HaYetzirah contains the secrets of creation. So they created calves to eat for Shabbos. And we have the Rabbeinu Sadia going, interestingly enough, who was a rationalist, say, oh yeah, Avraham Avinu knew Sefer HaYetzirah. And that's the tracing of Kabbalah even before Har Sinai, but certainly at Har Sinai as part of Torah Sheba'al Peh. So the Kodesh Baruch Hu delivers the Torah, he delivers two sections, Torah Shebichsav, Torah Sheba'al Peh. Let me just write something down. And in Torah Sheba'al Peh, there's the section that accompanies Torah Shebichsav, the verbal, the rational Torah, and then there's this entire tradition of about what happens above these worlds and before these worlds and maybe even after these worlds. Not just axiologically, but chronologically, before and after. And Rav Shimon bar Yochai and his 10 Talmidim started to lay greater emphasis. Why? That's a very interesting point. Why all of a sudden, it was always there, it was always latent, it was always discussed, to a degree it was discouraged. Remember, you shouldn't think of ourselves, Chagiyah shouldn't be speaking groups of more than three until you're 40. So there's always a little care because it's dangerous. It could lead to blasphemy, it could lead to heresy. It can, four people went into the paradise, the famous story, Ben Zon, Ben Azar. Not all of them emerged unscathed. So I was there, I was guarded, but all of a sudden, there's a renaissance, Shimon bar Yochai. Just like there's a renaissance in the 16th century when Spanish Jews are expelled. There's a lot of messiness, a lot of thought about where we are, what stage of history, why this is happening. The world is a little dark, so maybe there are other worlds that are a little lighter. Get that? When this world's a little dark, well, you got to make sense of it. So let's think about, well, it's just a small part of the universe. I mean the universe, small part of reality. Universe is a small part of reality. There are other theoretical worlds. And okay, in this small country called Spain, in this solar system, in this galaxy, in this universe, something traumatic happened. But let's keep our proportions intact. There are larger models that we think about. That's already my spin. It could be other spins. Why Hasidus takes Kabbalah. So if you ask a professor, all he can do is say data. I see the data. The book came out in 13th century. The book came out and we have no record of it before. But we have, we receive traditions, and our tradition tells us that Rav Shimon bar Yochai wrote the Zohar. So when we talk about Kabbalah, we see it as part of our Masorah written in later stages. Not all the some Svarim are written. Obviously, the Ariya Kodesh writes his Svarim and the Vilna Gaon writes his Svarim, people that write Svarim in Kabbalah, but the classics trace their way all the way back to Har Sinai and even before. Okay, so that's the third. The fourth is just very, very quick, just to get it out of the way. We're having this conversation because it's Lag BaOmer, because of Meron, because of Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Obviously, I want to take this conversation and universalize it beyond Rav Shimon bar Yochai. I want to give you a sense of what Kabbalah is. But what is Lag BaOmer all about, rather? What's Rav Shimon bar Yochai all about? What's his big congregation at the... Let's just make sure we pay a little attention to that. And then we'll get to the second part of this year. Okay, none of us really are practicing Kabbalah, at least right now. But how can Kabbalah help us broaden our Avodas Hashem, give us thoughts and processes that maybe accentuate parts in this world that Kabbalah lays greater emphasis? Okay. Rav Shimon bar Yochai, supposedly, close to his death, told his Talmidim, come to my kever, and good brachos will come from that. Okay, he didn't say come on Lag BaOmer. But he did say, come on the day I die, or there may be a typo, come on my happy day, because Yom Shemesi, Shin Mem Taf Yod Shemeti, if you add a chet, could be Yom Simchati, which could either be the day you die, the day you were born, or the day you got married. No one knows.
My Rami.
What?
My Rami spoke about this with us, and she was saying, it's 100% Yom Simchati, like that's...
Okay. It was all due respect. Yeah. People greater than her and greater than me.
Oh, yeah.
By a long shot, still don't know the answers. It's hard to know. These are texts and mysterious. At some point, okay, let's take a few steps back. The North has a lot of graves. Because the North was always the safety valve. When things got too heated in Jerusalem, people ran up north. The Tanaim ran up north. Yesi Haglili, Bidanasi, they all ran. Yesi Haglili, he's called Yesi Haglili. And the Jews from Spain went north, because the Turks invited them to Akko, to Tveria, to Tzvat. So a lot of graves there. And Jews would always go at certain points of the year to the graves of Tzaddikim, to pray for rain, to the graves of Hillel and Shammai in particular. That was a migration point. And not just for Jews, but just Google all this. You'll see pictures of Arabs a big rock in between the grave of Hillel and Shammai with water miraculously flowing through. So this environment of righteous people and their graves and people taking pilgrimages towards these graves goes back 800 years, 900 years, at least documented. Now, I'll talk about Rosh Hashanah and Baruch Hai in a second, but keep in mind these are very, very small, self-selective events. What's happening in Meron today is completely a product of mass transportation. You get on a bus and you're there. You get on a high-speed train and you're up north. To go to Meron or to go to Hillel and Shammai's grave, you either have to be local, which you live with these people and their aura your whole life, or take a five-week trip. Get on a donkey and then travel and stay. Today, it's a five-hour trip. Get on a lot of traffic, but aside from the traffic, you're there. So that's created this mass circus-like environment where people come in tens, or people, you get, when you go to Meron and you say, oh, that person, he's a makubal. I see he or she, they live their life based on Kabbalah the whole year. It makes sense for them to be there. That person, not so much. You know, they're not, maybe not even religious. They're there with loud music blaring. It's more of a culture event. And that's why this dissonance sets in, because it seems to be very artificial and vicarious to some. And you know, right, that person, I see the gardol, I see the big shtag, like, no, that's that person lives their life. It's coherent. It's holistic. It's very, very jarring and very uneven. It's because of mass transportation. Even if you look back in the early part of the century, before trains, before buses, you literally look at the pictures. There are 100 people there, 1,000 people there, 2,000 there. One gathers like a normal, regular-sized event. What you're picking up is because the jet fuel that moves this whole process into this mass circus is public transportation. What really locks in Lag BaOmer at Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's kever is the Ari HaKadosh. The Ari HaKadosh, based on the reports of his Talmid, Chaim Vital, travels, of course, from Spain to Yerushalayim, to Tzvat, and not from Spain, so travels from Tzvat to the grave and stays 3 days there, I think around the time of Lag BaOmer. And that's where this tradition of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai on Lag BaOmer visiting the grave entrenches itself in institutional. Again, it's really very, very minor. It's not what we're here to talk about today. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai obviously is the primary conduit of the Zohar, so that's why we're talking about it today. But we can give a whole separate shiur on Meron, what activities do make sense, what activities seem a little bit odd to us, how it happens. That's not really our focus, but at least I want you to, we're trying to clear the table of all this misinformation, just to know, your heads to be clear. What's Kabbalah? What's mysticism? Part of our Masara. Meron is a little bit strange because it's become a mass movement. Now let's get to the beat and the meat of the shiur. Okay. Rabbi, not a Makobol. You're not a Makobol. Neither of us are. I don't study Kabbalah, but I hear it, I listen to it, when I come across it, when I feel it. How does Kabbalah change me? What does Kabbalah lend to a non-Makubal's life? I already told you why I'm not involved in Kabbalah, because I just feel like, by and large, in this world, is enough for. And by the way, and I should say this as a caveat or as a disclaimer, before we enter, how Kabbalah affects me on the margins, like what aspect is it cross-pollinated? Oh yeah, it's an aspect that's stressed in Kabbalah. And when I play to the world of rational, exoteric Judaism, it helps me become a little bit more and become a little bit more and think about a little and focus on, so how can I use Kabbalah to catalyze non-Kabbalistic experiences? But even before that, people have come to me from time to time, and people in my family. I'm very ill. Medical science doesn't seem to have an answer. Been to several doctors. Can't quite put our finger on what's happening. Can't quite diagnose. Go see a Makubal. What is that, a cop-out? Magic tricks? Hocus pocus? Just said, you know. That's like going to a different doctor. Go to one doctor, he'll offer one antibiotic, one medicine, or a different doctor, a different strategy. Makubal just has different tools. I mean, the Makubal is some soothsayer with magic powers, superior like at the Game of Thrones. I never watched, but whatever. So, I imagine the magicians on there. Right. It just means a different set of tools. What would happen if you wanted to know whether someone was in the building? So the simple way was to enter the building. Can't enter the building, look through the windows. Let's say you couldn't enter, no doors, no windows. You fly over with a heat scanner and look at body heat and see these little red bodies moving around. You see the people in the house or not, where they are. Because you just have a different way of gathering information. You're using heat rather than light rays, or using heat emissions. If you were a dolphin, you wanted to communicate, you use sonar. You bounce it off. And a bat, different other things, also sonar, but just different ways to communicate, to gather information. So if I'm a doctor and I want to know what's ill, I'll do a biopsy, I'll perform maybe surgery, an MRI, X-ray. Also, let me look at this with non-scientific views and try to... There was just an article in the Israeli Times, it's a very fascinating article. There was evidently this Mekubal from up north who accompanied the army a few years ago and literally helped them uncover about 30 underground tunnels in Gaza. Because if I uncover underground tunnels, I put a seismic sensor into the ground, dig up some earth, pour some water, I use scientific tools to try to discover whether there's a terror tunnel. He's like looking at the landscape through a different lens. Doesn't mean he's superior. It seems superior because it provides solutions when we fall short. It's just like you get a plumber, different set of tools. No. I'm going to snake out the blockage because I've got a tool that's a little different. I've got a way to eat into the roots. I've got a way to snake through the roots. So there's nothing apologetic or to cop out. We operate in the world of nigla, not just halakhically, scientifically, and medically. When you hit that point that the world around us doesn't offer solutions, you know, let me try a different angle. Let me try someone that sees the world and processes the world with a different set of tools that we typically don't use because typically the tools we have work. Typically, we don't have blockages in our sewers, and when we do, we snake them out. But all of a sudden, typically, the antibiotics that my local doctor subscribes works. Now it's not. Let me get a sip, just like if I discover a new drug. So I'm trying to give you that sense. There's nothing shameful by going to a Mekubal. You're not walking back into Game of Thrones or into some medieval world of Harry Potter and wands. And you're just saying there are phenomena that the rational world just doesn't have solutions for. And I want to get to the heart of it. I'm not going to do that. I don't know if I have a bad day. Like, why am I in traffic? Let me ask him a Mekubal. Maybe if I'm in Kabbalah, I would. But if this person is ill or suffering a deep psychological crisis or can't get married or things of that sort, and all of the tools, then people make decisions. What is a crisis of severe proportions? At which point? But you shouldn't feel like, oh my goodness, I'm allergic to it because I'm entering into this strange world. And is that reflective of who I am? You're targeting the same endpoint, just getting a different strategy to get there. So it's going to take out all this offensiveness. I can't believe it. He told me to see him a Mekubal. Who does he think I am? He's insulting my intelligence. It's ridiculous. I'm insulted that you think I'm insulting your intelligence because your view of intellectualism is just so narrow-minded that you're eliminating alternate pathways to reach data and information. Okay, how does Kabbalah help? How does Kabbalah help me? Okay, here are four or five aspects. Number one, because it reminds us of the limit of rationing. And something I said about before. As much as we celebrate rationing, and please, don't suspect me. I'm a rationalist. Don't suspect me. I went to college. I can string a few sentences together. I got pretty good marks. I took it seriously, not just to get a degree, but to enrich myself. And I encourage you to take it seriously. I encourage you, develop your mind. It's the most powerful organ you possess. Learn to sharpen it. Rabbi, I got this question more for my kids. Why should I study math? I hate math. So there are deeper answers to that question. But at a basic level, because it makes your mind work better. And any of you who have this allergy to math, overcome it as quickly as you can. Because I promise you, you'll thank me for this. Famous story, Rav Aaron came to YU as a 16-year-old, asked the Rav, what should I study? The Rav said, you should study math. Rav Aaron came to him after half a semester or a semester and said, the Rav said, how was it? Rav Aaron said, I hated it. What should I do? The Rav said, study more math. I had a math blockage in high school. I just didn't get it. I said, there's only one way up the mountain, and that's clawing and digging. I said, I'm going to minor in math. Remember, this is YU, not MIT, so let's put things into perspective. But I got a minor degree in math. It wasn't easy. But I slugged my way through because I know I can't accept my limitations. I've got to transcend them. Like, send my limitations, and I'll just be me. I can't just find my sweet spot. Oh, I love studying poetry. I love reading history. I love reading literature. Maybe I'll study physics for poets. Maybe, max, right? Physics for poets. And I'll learn a little bit of Einstein, his biography, and that'll be my physics quote. No. Get into that. Sharpen your mind. thought, discrete thought, structures, logic, flow, the direct, I promise you, you'll thank me. Learn to develop your mind. We talked about before, think without music. Learn to focus all your mental energies without distractions. If you can't do it all the time, at least, like all exercise, do it 10 minutes a day, 3 minutes a day, build those muscles, start to build, you'll see, all of a sudden your brain works better. You analyze your world, people in your world, your life, your decision making, your people around you. You need to have analysis, but the greatest errors in the modern era are not fraud, but misallocation, where one value becomes the controlling value and the exclusive value and eliminates all other values and displaces. And the altar of the modern era is the altar of rationalism. And that everything that's non-rational, and wise people know that certain truths they can self-arbitrate, and certain truths have to be delivered. I said before, Har Sinai is verifiable. Good luck. In theory, it's verifiable. It makes it empirical, but there's no way you can prove it. And creation of the world, no one witnessed. So in theory, if we just had enough algorithms and data, but you're never going to. You just have to accept certain truths from people. And the sooner you wise up to that, the healthier that balance is. Okay, and there's this slogan, this drumbeat in the modern world, don't follow blindly. Don't just accept things. Prove them if you can't. And it's creating a imbalance in the way to be accepting and internalizing and proving itself. And everyone has their different dosage, where they accept and where they prove. Do they first accept and then prove? Do they prove it? But in your mind, you can't disqualify information simply because it's a delivered truth rather than a self-arbitrated truth. That dichotomy, that judgmentalism has to fall. There's truth out there. How will I access it? Some of it, independently. Some of it, it's enabled truth. Similarly, their experiences, these are all derivations of the same concept, ration, empiricism. Do you value only intellectual experiences? We realize there are such a broad range of experiences that you really, when's the last time you felt your spirit move? Was that intellectual? I'm on the lookout when I interview, don't tell anyone, because when I interview kids, I get a couple kids every year who are literally locked in prison up here. They're locked here. And I know that beneath the neck, nothing's happening. Nothing's trickling down. They're literally locked in here. Some kids are defensive about it. Some kids don't even know there's anything here. It's a real struggle of the modern world. They're doing a really good job in the upper altitude and not such a great job in the lower parts of the mountain. You know, so pouring all this information up here and all the markers and who wins the valedictorian and who gets into the colleges and not so much down here. Now again, it has to trickle down, and a lot happens here and it trickles down, but what's happening in your psyche when you feel your spirit moving, your emotion? And Kabbalah reminds me that it's not so much about only what's happening here. It's like this check and balancing against hyper-empiricism and hyper-intellectualism. Science. I spell science with a small s. Modern man spells science with a capital S. Science! I say science. There is a conflict between science and religion. Okay. Because we're operating on different frames, different frequencies. Science is discussing one small aspect of our reality. It doesn't try to prove it. Science can't talk about that those other parts of reality. It's not science. It's science. I'm thrilled that we have it. It's a uniquely powerful tool. We should embrace it and utilize it as best we can. But it's not as if I'm shaking in fear and trembling and my knees are wobbling because science suggests, okay. Science suggests about, it frames that whole world for me. Rationalism, empiricism, thought, cognition, science, it's great. And I use it, I'm thrilled to be an ambassador of, hopefully, of analytics and brisker derech and how to cut apart a sugya and how to add, read the, of course. But it's a slice. It's not all. It creates perspective on that entire world that I think modernity obfuscates and obscures. It's so large and so spit. It's a part. It's a part of the formula. That's number one. That's my first takeaway from Kabbalah. It always reminds me it's a part. Similarly, it always reminds me not just about cognition and rationalism being a part, but also this world being a part. It's the same message, but not about, look at me, girls, not about this being a part of a larger experience as a human being, but this world, this cosmos that we know, or universe that we know, just being a part of many other worlds. And it makes me, I think it gives a healthy proportion about Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. You're here. A lot of exciting things out there. Have a good life. Be successful. Hopefully healthy. Be productive. Right? But it's a 90-year run. 90 is the new 80. 90-year run, 120-year run. And not everything. There's a certain hubris that this world produces. And there's a certain, it helps reduce the world to a slice-sized magnitude, just like it helps reduce cognition. It frames. It helps you step out. Modern man is suffering from cycloptic vision. Remember Cyclops from Greek mythology, that one-eyed monster? We see things with one eye, and the screens are making it worse. Because we see things with one eye, and we see two dimensions. So we're cycloptic, and we're dimensionally challenged. Used to be people used two eyes and three dimensions. And we use one eye, the eye of ration, in two dimensions. And Kabbalah gives us that other eye and gives us literally that other dimension. And I don't look at those other dimensions too deeply. I pretty much look at the same world you look at. But in life, perspective and proportion is everything. Perspective and proportion is how you frame it. And within what you cast it, and what you surround it with, and how you dictate and determine your field of study, and what your, it's like when you learn a sugya. What are we studying? What, okay, that's a different sugya. We're not going to get into that. Let's look at this halacha. What halacha are you learning now? Gemara. Who's learning Gemara? Any, what halacha? What's the last sugya?
Migo.
Migo?
What?
Oh, all right. So the mitzvah of Leo Laregel and Harashem Yerah, and so all of a sudden there's some halacha that comes up and tells us that's not considered mitzvah of Leo Laregel. That's not considered. This, we're talking about this mitzvah. Not, yeah, there's a little point of overlap that tells us brings. We'll get to that. So you always want to dictate your field. Okay, we're studying about Elio and Malachim. Okay, when we study about Izevel, we'll think about Izevel. There's a little interaction in Elio and Izevel, but right now we're focusing on how it affects Elio and how. So it frames and it contextualizes. I should use my notes because I prefer them. Number three. Okay, number three. Remember I told you Kabbalah thinks about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu zigzags. I don't know, I'm just using a very, I mean zigzags, but trickles down all the way to our reality. And not just in our reality, but everything that we know, not just in a mitzvah, not just in a gemara, not just in a Beis HaMedrash or a Beis HaKnesses. Which means that Kabbalah is always creating intimacy with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is more present in the field of study in Kabbalah. And that's why the Rambam, you know, I talked about that little point of clash between the Rambam and Kabbalah, because Kabbalah does a lot of personification of Hashem's emanations to make it more accessible. And the Rambam says, no, don't do any of that. Doesn't talk about Kabbalah, but he rails against any degree to apply human form, human image, human imagination, human concepts. And Kabbalah is saying, well, what are the traits of Hashem? What are the traits? But the emanation of the emanation of the emanation of the emanation of the nation, and what are these two sides, the female side, the male side, the point and the counterpoint, the balance and the... And that's why it's so dangerous. That's why it has to be studied very carefully in small groups, only at a certain advanced age. But it's clear. If you ask me, okay, you taught us a lot about Rav Amital. You taught us a lot about Rav Lichtenstein. Break it down. And we talk, break it down to 14, break it down to 4. On my top 5 list of what I felt these people gave me, when they were in the room, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was in the room. It was very clear to me that Hashem was there. They made that relationship. Before I met them, I was a good Jew, but wasn't so connected to Hashem. When they were there, Hashem was in the room. It just became part of my life. They made Hashem palpable to me. Intimacy. I talked to him. I felt like I wanted to know him and understand him and how he created. It changed the coordinates of what I was thinking about. And Kabbalah has that way. And when you hear the tonality of Kabbalah, because in the world of rationalism, you're studying a lot of topics. And you hope that at every moment, yeah, I'm studying Parashem Yirah or Shalosh Pa'am Shana Yirah Kol Zechorecha because it's Hashem's mitzvah and I want to know more about Hashem or becoming the mitzvah properly. But that's a transitional point. That's a translation that some people don't make. Remember I said some people are locked here and then never hits here? Similarly, some people get locked in the information and it isn't always traceable back, okay, because I'm learning, halacha is a little bit easier because halacha you translate into obedience. I say, well, why am I obeying? Who am I obeying? Why does it make a difference what I'm doing on Shabbos? Because it's a Ratzon Hashem and I want to keep Shabbos and I want to keep Nida and I want to keep Kashrus and I want to... What about Gemara? What about Tanakh? Jewish history, fabled stories of our ancient predecessors. I want to learn about HaKadosh Baruch Hu's historical demands of us and how we challenged ourselves to reach them and we fail. It just doesn't always lead back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In Kabbalah, Hashem is always in the crosshairs. Because you're thinking about how Hashem makes his way into our reality and how his presence is scattered in our reality and you want to bring him back. So that's number 3. Making Hashem more front and center, front lobe, rather than back lobe, or not at all. Number 4. In Kabbalah, and this is one of the fundamentals of Kabbalah. Remember I talked about Kabbalah being top down, upper realms affecting lower realms, and those lower realms affecting even lower realms, affecting even lower realms until we get to our world. But it's also bottom up. It's a cycle. In Kabbalah, it's known as it re'usa de la'ela, top influence, top his auras, namely whatever happens in those upper supernal realms affects our world. But there's also is re'usa de la'tata. What happens in this realm cycles back and affects upper realms that in turn affect the universe. That activates man to be an agent of change in this world and an agent of redemption in this world. It changes the view of human experience. Human experience is not just dictated to, but impactful upon the universe in a broad scheme. And a Mekubal is always thinking about redemption and not just geographical and historical and Jews back in Israel, but redeeming the universe. We'll talk about this a little bit later on the point number 5. Hashem's presence is scattered. The world couldn't contain Hashem's presence. Hashem's presence became scattered. Everywhere there would need tzotzos and sparks and we get all these tzotzos and reintegrate them in the way that reflects HaKadosh Baruch Hu's indivisibility and integration. If you're a Mekubal, you get up every night at 12 o'clock. No, I don't get up, I stay. I remember they went to bed earlier. They went to bed at 8. They got up at 4. Somehow, our ethos of hasmada shifted. To be a masmid 500 years ago, you stayed up till 9 o'clock. Well, I'm sorry, it's the opposite. You got up at 2 o'clock. Because by 8 o'clock, you couldn't learn anymore because it's dark. In our world, oh, she's really burning the midnight oil. I'm staying up till 2 because she's learning as much. It's a shift of timing. They went to sleep at 8 o'clock. And if you really push the end, they got up at 12 or 1. David HaMelech got up every night at 12. He didn't go to bed at 11:30. I never go to bed at 11:30, but as I do on like the nights I need extra sleep. He didn't go to bed at 11:30. He went to bed at 10. Or it's up 2 hours. He pushed it, but people are going to bed at earlier times. What are we talking about? Right, so you got up at Chatzos, and you mourned the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which is, I'll say in point number 5, was not just a national mourning, but a universal mourning. Imagine getting up every night and thinking about how the world is broken and how you can repair the world, and hopefully tomorrow night you'll mourn a little bit less. It's a whole different mindset. It activates human experience. So let me give you an example. Chaim Volozhin, who writes a lot about Kabbalah in his Nefesh HaChaim. Because you know what's the upper world, even before those four worlds of translation? Because it's all translating Hashem's essence into reality. But the bridge between HaKadosh Baruch Hu's infinity and all those translations is His will. Girls, what do we call will? Torah. So look at me, little old me, in the lowest world, little puny me. Let me show you how empowered I am. I'm going to read a Rambam, or make believe I'm reading a Rambam. And when I read this Rambam, all of a sudden Torah is affected above the upperest worlds, and then starts to channel greater Torah energy to every single world, and affects 6 billion people on this earth. Because I read a Rambam. You want to change the world? Read a Rambam. Read a Blat Gemara. Oh yeah, you're changing the world by solving cancer. It's nice, but small little quadrant in a small little world. I'm changing the world by learning a Blat Gemara and leapfrogging, going to a point that's so primary, the apex point, because Torah is Hashem's will. Then that will starts to trickle down to every part that affects our universe. So, oh yeah, it's nice and sweet that you're solving cancer, but I'm learning the next toss. Again, I'm just saying it in an exaggerated form. I don't really believe that. Obviously, we believe that everything is productive. That's trying to change your lenses. Oh, yeah, that little yeshiva bachur in Bnei Brak, that parasite who's just studying another Blat Gemara while we're changing the world. Wait a second, who's going to have the last laugh? You're changing a small, little piece of a small, little chip of paint. And he's creating a fresco of the entire reality, because he's trying to reach some upper point. My point is, all of a sudden, you're not just living in a world. You are advancing and shaping the world and creating the world. It becomes activist rather than passive. It becomes empowering rather than enfeebling. And again, in Kabbalah, it has a whole difference that I'm not a Kabbalah. I'm not a Mekubal. Here's a little secret. Sounds like I like Kabbalah? I'll prove to you how much I like Kabbalah. When I say Sfiras HaOmer, I don't say those things. Hod Shebahod, Teferes Shebeteferes. Because I have too much respect for those phrases, and I know that they mean things that I don't even know what they mean, and I'm not going to cheapen them. Oh, Teferes means beauty. And Hod means splendor. Oh, come on. Hod is some aspect of some lattice, of some world that reflects some emanation of Hashem counterpart. If I'd studied 10 years, or maybe even 10 months or 10 minutes, about what those terms really mean, also I'm just going to walk in there and make them give you my 10th grade essay on what Tiferes means. A combination of a... I have too much respect for a Kabbalah just to rattle off phrases that I don't even know. They don't mean the traits that you receive on your 10th grade. Oh, she's a very diligent student. She dresses nicely. He's a peacemaker. He's in class. He's a Tiferes. Bonus one, these are cosmos-altering features of upper worlds that Hashem created, and I have to study them really well. I don't want to say them because I believe so deeply in them. You're not going to just short shrift them by just rattling them off without even knowing what they mean. I don't shake when I think about it. I just don't know what they mean. I know enough to know that I don't know. So again, you could say it. I'm obviously hypersensitive to what you say, but don't all of a sudden just give these simple English translations that you can find on a website about ideas that great minds study years and years and years and years to understand how they interact with the whole system. Like, you wouldn't say, oh, all of a sudden I know Pythagoras because you know what a triangle is? Do you even begin to know how that theory affects reality and our world is built on math and angles and degrees? And so all of a sudden it changes my view of the world. Finally, make sure we have enough time for this. Number five, and I've told you this before. So much of Judaism today, success in being an Oved Hashem today, is calibrating between nationalism and universalism. The Jewish world, at least the religious Jewish world, and still, religious encounters, even all branches who view themselves as religious, is polarized between hyper-nationalists and hyper-universalists. There's some people who are deep, deep nationalists. I don't just mean politically. Their experience is very Jewish, insular, massively invested internally, whether it's in the state building of Israel, whether it's in the community building of Crown Heights, or Panevish, or Lakewood, or we learn Torah, we build communities, we gather tzedakah for the local mikvah, we keep mitzvahs, we make sure our community is in order. And sometimes that leads to neglect or even bigotry and racism towards people who are not Jewish, as if they don't count and they don't matter. And that's off. I've told this story several times over the last couple of weeks. So I was a rabbi in a Pesach program this past Pesach up north. And one day between Mincha and Ma'arav, I said, let's say some Tehillim. So I said, who's sick? Who's ill? Rabbi, what's up? I said, no one's ill. Everyone's healthy. Why are we saying Tehillim in the middle of Yom Tov? I said, there were over 300 people who were killed in Sri Lanka. We're celebrating our selection as the children of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. How can you go to another buffet tonight, to another carving station, and get some more meat down your throat without even acknowledging that there are 300 plus people were killed and 600 maimed? That's part of Pesach. We're not chosen to just go to a hotel. We're chosen to be. We celebrate it by going to a hotel. But you don't have to know what you're celebrating. There's got to be some content. Otherwise, it's just in a seven-day orgy. We're celebrating the fact that we're Jews. And by the way, an event happened that we as Jews have to register. Doesn't mean we have to get on a plane. Doesn't mean we have to deliver all of our charity to the Sri Lankans, but at the very least, say to them that for the people whose lives are crushed. Otherwise, Pesach isn't Pesach. And then there are other types of Jews, and you've met them. We all share the same DNA. This is the modern world. All that talk about being the chosen people, the children of God, the state of Israel, and return to the ancient homeland, that's so tribalistic. That's so nationalistic and parochial. You know, you're a fascist. I love that term. Everyone's a fascist today. When someone insults someone, call them a fascist. No one knows what they're talking about. You're a fascist. Anyone who's not a hyper-liberal, who's willing to accept every person's values, oh, you're a fascist. And it's about finding that middle space and understanding that they're the same. You want to help the Palestinians? Settle the next hill in the West Bank. What does that mean, Rabbi? Don't report me to the UN High Commission of Human Rights. How are you helping the Palestinians by settling the next land? You know what? Because my end game is the arrival of Mashiach and the introduction of welfare for the entire world on their terms. I don't want anyone to be Jewish. No conversion agenda. Not a missionary. Mashiach comes, the entire world will benefit. On their terms. Utopia. No more war. No more illness. No more poverty. No more strife. Nothing. The world just doesn't know it yet. It's a broken world. So I've got to navigate that broken world. But are you kidding me? Settling a hilltop is the most universalistic act I can take, fundamentally. I'm just not in that world right now that sees it that way. So I have to play nice in the sandbox and in a real way and accept the terms of my reality. But ultimately, every national act is a universal act. And every universal act is a reaffirmation of a national calling. Like davening for Sri Lankan is part of your Pesach. What do you mean, Rabbi? Part of Pesach. It's matzah, it's maror, it's echle mikdash kehillah, it's chasam sefer, and then this Haggadah, and that Haggadah, and Rabbi Sachs' Haggadah, and this, what are you talking about, Sri Lanka? That's part of Pesach? Of course it is. Because it's the one you chose. So it's about that balance. Kabbalah helps remind me of that universalism. Because Kabbalah is about everything. It's not about a people or a planet. It's about reality. Think even about the fall. Every form of processing of Avodas Hashem talks about the fall. So we think about two falls of man. The fall of the Jewish people, Egel, Miraglim, Beis HaMikdash Rishon, Beis HaMikdash Sheni, our betrayals, and the fall of Adam HaRishon, the moral fall of man's first disobedience, which in theory could be overlapping. We had a chance to recover from Gan Eden, and Har Sinai we failed again. So essentially at Har Sinai was the Chet of Adam HaRishon revisited, because we had restored that original moment. And therefore, Geula is trying to recover from those falls and return to our land, and return to the Beis HaMikdash, and become more moral. In Kabbalah, there is a prior fall, and it's not a moral dysfunction. It's Hashem created this world, and Hashem's indivisible, integrated self became scattered in this world of division. Molecules, pieces, matter. Not that anyone did anything wrong, like Adam did something wrong, made a mistake. Am Yisrael, the Egel, made an error, the Meraglim. It's about the incompatibility of our world and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's indivisibility. And I want to try to reshape the world. L'shem yichud kucha. I want to take Hashem and integrate His essence. And so all of a sudden, you're not just looking at the West Bank, Gush Etzion, what's happening in Migdal Oz. You're saying, well, there's cosmology here. I'm involved in the entire reality. And it reminds you that it's not just this narrow parochial experience, even though most of my life is narrow. I'm not flying on planes to foreign countries, delivering talks about flying planes to other countries, but primarily with Jews, but I'm not flying out to India, speaking to 100 million Indians about their future. If they invite me, maybe I'll go. But I'm talking to Jews about Torah and about this Gemara and that. So my day-to-day feels very parochial in its substance. But what you might say, it's not about that. It's about, in addition to that parochialism, this universalism. Those are the 5 points that I take from Kabbalah into my world. Number one, the limits of ration, limits of cognition, science with a small s, not a capital S. Number two, it's a slice of reality. It isn't reality. It feels like reality because it's really large. All of a sudden, you go into that Google and you look at the Earth from Google and say, oh, it's just a planet. When you're on Earth, it feels really large. When you're above Earth, it's a planet, and there are other planets. Well, it's not just there are other planets, there are other realms. This entire universe is just one realm. Imagine it's like walking out the door of this entire universe into another room. Imagine two rooms. The room feels pretty big. It feels pretty concrete and material, but it's just a room, and you walk to the other room. So you don't really, I don't walk out of that room too often, but at least I know it's just a room. It's not a complete, complete reality. Number three, Hashem. Hashem is there in Kabbalah. You're talking about Hashem. You're personifying Hashem. And there are times that I feel Kabbalah more deeply. When do I feel Kabbalah more deeply? Shabbos. Creation, Hashem's decision. Let's say some Kabbalistic, a lot of ours, Miros, Lechadodi, was written by a Mekubal. People sing about Rishim by Yochai on Shabbos. I was going to think about Kabbalah more often on Shabbos if you're attuned to Shabbos. And again, most of you aren't coming back next year, right? Whoever is going to be, especially in a non-Jewish framework, like in this immersion in secular colleges, the first bit of advice I could give you is, you have to plan your Shabbos. This is not Kabbalistic. This is rational. Every week before it comes, what do I hope to accomplish over the Shabbos? It could be very minimal. Because your weeks are going to be zany. And your weeks are not going to necessarily be that attuned to religion. Hopefully towards performance, but growth and spirituality. You've got to say, okay, now it's Shabbos. At the very least, have a plan for Shabbos. I'm going to make sure I'm rested enough that I'm going to go to Maariv or go to Shacharis on time or sit down for half an hour and learn some Torah or make sure that I have a Kiddushik. It has to be planned. Shabbos can't just be recovery. I know I'm exhausted, I'm going to recover and study. Because then you become spiritually empty. Shabbos is spiritual replenishment, however you define it. It could be an Onik Shabbos, it could be a Tish, it could be a... I'm not telling you how to define it, but you have to have a plan. Then 24 hours, I'll be a little bit replenished. I will have learned more, I will have daven better. I would have thought, just think for a little, just take a half an hour and say, you're not the Tish girl, you're not the learning, that's not your thing. I'm going to sit down for half an hour and just, what did I do well this week? What did I do not so well? What did I get right? What did I get wrong? Just a cheshbon nefesh. Doesn't have to be this heart pounding, cutting. Okay, you know, I could improve here a little bit. I should have done this a little. Just something. It can't just be food, sleep, and study, and friends. Because then it's a slippery slope, and then more aphasia, and then all of a sudden you wake up 4 years later and you're spiritually dry. It's hard to jumpstart, because then you start to get married and you start your profession, and then you start to juggle 7 balls. Now you're starting with 2-3 balls. You study, all of a sudden, you kind of, as adults, you got to study, and you have to develop the ability to initiate religious thought, even while you're juggling 7 balls. So if you do it when juggling 2-3 balls, okay, it becomes second nature. And you're developing a thirst for it. And you know something's off if you're not feeding the monster, you're not feeding the appetite. You know, okay, but I gotta hear something and think of something. So it becomes something you do on the fly. But you have to do it first to do it on the fly. Okay, so Shabbos, I feel a little bit sphere Omer, obviously, because you're counting time and the 7x7, which is very Kabbalistic, 7x7 lattice. I feel in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that's obviously a time to feel Kabbalah because you're talking about the world being So there are times you feel, honestly, I don't feel it that much on Hanukkah. I don't feel it that much, when I bend Birchas HaMazon. So there are times that I feel I'm part of something larger. That's number 2. Number 3, Hashem's in the room, as we spoke about. Number 4, not just in this world, receiving and performing and obeying, but somehow impacting and changing and shaping. And number 5, I may be in a very small space on my day-to-day, but that space impacts a broader equation. And never give up that belief. I know the world doesn't accommodate it and reinforce it, but they're the same. The you that performs halacha, and the you that davens, and the you that's Jewish on Shabbos and that hangs around with Jews in your small little shul, and then the you that shows up on Monday at work with Gentiles and holds it. Many people never integrate those yous because they just feel different. And you're going to show up in your classes next year. Those of you who won't be in Stern or the equivalent, you're going to show up in, I don't know, Columbia, or sitting next to Asians and sitting next to Italians. And this is very different. Last year, I was sitting in Migdal Oz in the West Bank, studying Torah, hearing, and now you feel very different. And it leads to schizophrenia. I don't mean clinical schizophrenia, religious schizophrenia. That leads to what we had last year. It's really nice, but come on, this is Columbia. That was a nice little parenthesis where it took a year to, but this is reality. It creates compartmentalization and lack of cross-pollination. And you know what? They're the same. You're here and you're there. You're striding these two cycles. And they're the same. Just remember what Rabbi Tarragon said. The best thing I can do for Palestinians is settle hell in the West Bank. That sounds crazy. That's crazy talk. Don't tell it to your BDS classmate. Of course, they don't get it. And I understand they don't get it. I'm not expecting them to. I'm not surprised they don't get it. I'm not angry they don't get it. But I get it. And it doesn't mean that I disrespect people's rights. I'm very, very... I tell people every time I drive, and just here today I was thinking about it, because every time I drive, I always try to give right-of-way to Palestinian drivers. Because for me, to get to Yerushalayim takes 25 minutes without traffic. Well, a Palestinian, it takes them an hour and a half, 2 hours. Roadblock, and it's not their fault. Most of them are innocent people, regular civilians, husbands, wives, children, grandparents. You got the terrorists and the militants, and you've got to ferret them out, so they have to go through roadblocks. But the least I can do is give a half a second of my life to restore someone's lost dignity. So if it means that the traffic circle, letting an Arab sibling go, big deal, so I get to Yerushalayim a split second later, it's an incredible opportunity to give someone dignity, restore some of the sentimental that sadly has to be taken. I'm a big supporter of roadblocks. I'm not anti-roadblock person. What do they call that? Breaking the silence. I'm not part of that organization. I don't go to roadblocks and hold protests, but it's sad. It's sad. A hot day. Today's pretty hot, pretty brutal. Get out of your car and open your trunk, and it's hard. It's really hard to see. Happy we have the roadblocks. So since just today I was driving to Migdal Oz, so I got to the traffic circle. It was really my right away. Okay, at a certain point it becomes dangerous if you don't drive based on the flow. People behind you bumping, just like I had to go. I felt bad. Should I have given him the right of way? He's a 55-year-old guy. He looked like a nice guy. So I'm always like, should I give? Should I not give? You don't want to be driving behind me. If you are driving behind me, be prepared for sudden stops. So But I believe that the best I can serve them is by being an ardent settler, which is what I do with my time. I don't see that as parochial. I don't see that as an obstacle to peace, obstacle. Okay, we live in a world in which isn't yet synchronized, so we'll get there. But don't give up that sense. Don't ever give up. Don't ever let that become polarized in you. And don't find yourself migrating with one side or another. You know, those people out there, don't care about them. Or those people in there, they're so tribal, and they're so insular, they don't always see that the two are meant to overlap. Okay? Happy Lag Bomber, everyone.
Thank you.
Pop your heads on a swivel. That's my job. Lie detector and head swiveling. Find people like that in your life. Reinforcing dogma won't get you forward in life. Breaking your stigmas and swiveling your head, that's where it's at. Rav Amital used to swivel us. Came in one way, all of a sudden your head was facing the other way. That's what you need to find. Okay, have a good day. Drink.
First target?
Yeah.